Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Usually, when we dig into a stack of sources, we're, trying to zoom out.
Right. We look at the macro trends, economics, history, big social shifts.
Exactly. But today, we're doing the exact opposite. We're shrinking down.
Way down.
We're going to the atomic level to try and solve what is essentially a cold case in the world of metallurgy.
And honestly, cold case is the perfect way to describe it, although physically speaking, it's a very hot case.
Right.
We are stepping into a massive scientific turf war that was raging in the early 1980s. The subject is a specific, somewhat mysterious microstructure in steel called bainite.
Bainite. It sounds like something that would weaken Superman like Kryptonite's boring cousin, but it turns out it's actually the hero in a lot of modern engineering.
It's crucial for making high-strength steel. But for a long time, nobody could agree on how it actually formed.
To help us crack this case, we have a fascinating document in the stack. It's a conference paper from 1981.
That's right. It's titled An Atom Probe Study of Bainite by HKDH Padeshia and A.R. Waugh from the University of Cambridge.
And this paper, it's not just about metal, is it? It's bigger than that.
Oh, much bigger. It's about a fundamental disagreement on how matter transforms from one state to another. The core question is, when steel changes its structure, do the atoms move slowly, sort of, swimming through the solid to find new spots?
Or do they snap into place instantly, like a military formation changing shape on a drill sergeant's command?
Precisely. That's the classic diffusion versus martensitic debate.
We are going to get into the nitty-gritty of that. But before we do, I have to mention the weapon they used to solve this mystery. The paper focuses on an imaging atom probe.
Yeah.
Which, frankly, sounds incredibly sci-fi for 1981.
It does sound like science fiction, doesn't it? But it was very real, and for the time, absolute cutting edge. It allowed these researchers to do something that had been almost impossible before.
Which was what?
To look at the chemistry of steel, atom by atom.
That is wild to think about. We aren't talking about a microscope zooming in. We are talking about literally counting individual atoms to settle an argument.
That's it. And to set the stage, we need to apply the principles of objective scientific analysis here. The authors, Padeshia and Waugh, are incredibly rigorous. They aren't guessing.
No.
They're looking for a chemical signature. They need to find out how bainite grows by looking at where the atoms end up.
Okay, let's unpack the crime scene.
Mm.
What exactly is the bainite reaction, and why were so many intelligent people arguing about it?
Okay, so imagine you have a piece of steel. You heat it up until it's glowing red hot around 1100 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm.
At this temperature, the iron atoms are arranged in a structure called austenite. Think of it as your starting lineup. The atoms are happy, they have space, everything is stable.
So we have hot, glowing austenite, the atoms are in their high-energy party mode.
Exactly. Now, you cool it down. If you quench it, cool it really, really fast, it snaps into a hard, brittle form called martensite. That is a displacive transformation.
Displacive?
The atoms just shear into a new shape. There is no time for them to move around or swap places.
Like a steel trap springing shut. Or, I was thinking, like a deck of cards being pushed sideways. The cards don't change order. The whole deck just shifts.
Precisely. That is a perfect analogy. But if you cool it very slowly, the atoms have time to wander. They diffuse.
Ah.
They separate into different ingredients. That's a diffusion-controlled transformation.
Okay, so fast equals snap or shear. Slow equals swim or diffuse. Where does bainite sit in?
Bainite forms in the middle ground. You cool it to an intermediate temperature. In this experiment, they held it at 340 degrees Celsius, and you get this structure that looks like plates or needles.
And that middle ground is why it was so controversial.
That's it.
The debate was essentially, is bainite forming because atoms are diffusing the slow swim, or is it snapping into place like the fast shear?
Exactly. And this isn't just academic nitpicking. If it's diffusion, chemistry dictates the speed. If it's martensitic, mechanical forces dictate the speed. It changes how you design alloys entirely.
Knowing the mechanism tells you how strong or tough you can make that steel.
Right. So enter Padeshia and Waugh. They set up a trap. They aren't using plain iron. They're using a specific recipe. I have it here. Iron with 0.39% carbon, 2.05% silicon, and 4.08% nickel.
Why that specific mix? Why not just iron and carbon?
That composition is the key to the whole investigation. They chose high silicon and nickel because those are what we call substitutional alloying elements.
Explain that distinction for us, because I know carbon plays a different role than silicon or nickel.
Think of the iron lattice like a brick wall. Most of the bricks are iron, but every once in a while you pull out an iron brick and you substitute it with a nickel brick or a silicon brick.
Okay.
They sit in the lattice structure. They are heavy, large atoms, relatively speaking.
So they're part of the main structural integrity. They're the heavy bricks replacing other bricks.
Right. Carbon, on the other hand, is tiny. It's an interstitial element.
Interstitial.
It doesn't replace a brick. It squeezes into the mortar, into the cracks between the bricks. It can move much, much faster and easier than the big metal atoms.
So we have the heavy bricks, silicon and nickel, and the sand in the cracks, the carbon.
Perfect. Now, follow the logic here. If the Bainate reaction is driven by diffusion, mm-hmm. by atoms swimming around finding new homes, those silicon and nickel atoms would have to move.
They have to partition.
Yes. You'd see a pile up of them in one area and a lack of them in another, because in diffusion, atoms move to where they're most comfortable.
Right. Given enough time, they'll segregate.
Exactly. But if it's the snap method, the Martensitic shear, what happens to the bricks?
Well, if I shove a brick wall sideways, the red bricks and the blue bricks don't swap places. They stay next to their neighbors. The whole wall just leans.
Exactly. They get frozen in. So the mission was simple. Look at the Bainite and see if the nickel and silicon moved. If they moved, it's diffusion. If they stayed put, it's shear.
But seeing that requires that sci-fi tool we mentioned.
Yeah.
We need to talk about this imaging atom probe. How does this thing actually work?
It's a brilliant, if somewhat violent, technique. They take a tiny needle-shaped sample of the steel.
Really small.
Microscopic. They put it in a vacuum and apply a massive electric field to it. This field is so strong that it literally rips atoms off the surface of the metal one by one.
You're ripping them off.
It ionizes them. And then it measures how long it takes for that ion to fly down a tube to a detector. This is the time of flight spectrometer.
Ah, okay.
Heavy atoms fly slower, light atoms fly faster.
So by timing them, you know exactly who just hit the plate. Iron, carbon, silicon, or nickel.
You got it. And because it's an imaging probe, they can reconstruct where they came from on the sample. They focus specifically on the interface, the border between the new Bainite and the old Austenite.
They wanted to see if atoms were piling up at the border.
That's what they were looking for.
Okay, so let's get to the verdict. They looked at the heavy bricks, the silicon, and nickel. Did they move?
They found nothing.
Nothing.
No movement. The silicon and nickel concentrations in the Bainite were identical to the concentrations in the Austenite. They did not redistribute at all.
So the bricks didn't swap places.
They stayed put. This was a massive piece of evidence. The authors state it clearly. Substitutional alloying elements do not redistribute during the Bainite transformation.
That seems definitive. If the heavy atoms didn't move, the lattice must have sheared. It must be Martensitic. Case closed, right?
You would think so. It strongly supports the theory that the iron lattice changes shape mechanically. But the mystery wasn't solved yet.
Oh.
Because while the heavy brick stayed put, the carbon went absolutely wild.
Yes. The carbon complication, I see here in the notes that while the silicon and nickel were boring, the carbon was non-uniformly distributed.
Right. When they analyzed the retained austenite, the part of the metal that hadn't turned into Bainite yet, they found huge spikes in carbon concentration.
So in some places, it was way higher than the average.
Way higher, yep. Which is a problem.
Wait, isn't that a paradox? We just said it's a snap transformation where atoms get frozen in place. If it's frozen, how is the carbon moving around?
That is the million-dollar question. If you're a proponent of the diffusion theory, you look at that carbon moving and you say, aha, see? Atoms are moving. It's diffusion.
But the silicon and nickel say it's not. So we have conflicting witnesses.
We do. So Padeshia and Hua had to figure out when the carbon moved. Did it move during the transformation or after?
How can you possibly tell the difference? You're looking at the sample after the experiment is over. It's like looking at a car crash and trying to figure out if the driver hit the brakes before or after the impact.
You have to look at the thermodynamics, and this is where the paper gets really clever. The authors propose a sequence of events.
Yeah.
First, a plate of Bainite forms. It snaps into existence. Because the silicon and nickel don't move, we know the lattice sheared. And because it happened so fast, the carbon was initially trapped inside the Bainite.
So for a split second, you have Bainite that is absolutely stuffed with carbon.
Full supersaturation, as they call it. The Bainite holds all the carbon that was in the original austenite. But here's the catch. Bainite really, really hates holding that much carbon. It's structurally very uncomfortable.
Like holding your breath. You can do it for a second, but you have to let it out immediately.
Exactly. So immediately after the subunit of Bainite forms, maybe microseconds later, it rejects the carbon. It spits it out into the remaining austenite surrounding it.
So the carbon movement is a post-game show. It happens after the structure has already changed.
That is their conclusion. The diffusion of carbon happens subsequent to the transformation. That explains why the silicon and nickel are frozen proof of the snap, but the carbon is partitioned proof of the cleanup afterwards.
That makes sense conceptually, but the paper doesn't just rely on a story. They back it up with what I'll call thermodynamic detective work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at these graphs, figure 1A and figure 2A, and we have these curves labeled T0 prime and A3 prime. This looks like the heavy math section.
It is, but it's actually quite intuitive if you break it down. Think of these curves as speed limits or boundaries. The AE3 double prime curve represents equilibrium.
Yep.
That's the state the metal would reach if you left it in the oven for a million years. Everything is balanced. Everyone is happy.
Ideally where nature wants to go.
Yeah.
The path of least resistance.
Right. Now, the T0 prime curve is different. This is a theoretical limit. It represents the point where the energy of the austenite and the bainite is exactly equal for the same composition.
Okay. Why does that line matter?
Because you can only have that snap, that partitionless Martensitic transformation, if you are below the T0 prime line.
Ah.
If you cross that line, there simply isn't enough thermodynamic energy to force the lattice to shear without moving atoms around.
So T0 prime is the no-snap zone. If you cross it, you can't snap anymore.
Exactly. Now, remember the weird fact you mentioned earlier? The reaction in their experiment stopped early.
Right. They held it for 10 hours.
Yeah.
But a lot of austenite never turned into bainite. It just quit.
Right. Why would it stop halfway? This is what they call the incomplete reaction phenomenon. And it perfectly matches the logic we just discussed. A bainite plate forms. Snap. It's full of carbon.
Mm-hmm.
It spits that carbon out into the surrounding austenite. Now, that little patch of austenite has more carbon than it did before.
It's getting crowded with carbon.
Then another bainite plate forms nearby. Snap. Spits out more carbon. The carbon level in the remaining austenite keeps rising.
I see where this is going. The trash is piling up.
Eventually, the carbon concentration in the austenite gets so high that it hits that T0 prime curve.
The limit.
The limit. Suddenly, the austenite is too stable. The thermodynamic driving force required to snap into bainite drops to zero. The reaction chokes itself off.
That's fascinating. It's like painting yourself into a corner. The bainite creates so much carbon pollution in the surrounding area that no new bainite can form.
Precisely. And the atom probe data in figure 1A shows this alignment perfectly. The carbon concentration in the austenite stops almost exactly at the T0 prime boundary, not the equilibrium AE3 double prime boundary.
So that difference stopping at T0 prime instead of AE3, that's the smoking gun.
It is. If it were simple diffusion, just atoms swimming around, they would have kept going until they reached equilibrium. They wouldn't care about the snap energy limit. The fact that it stopped at the T0 prime line is huge evidence that the mechanism is restricted by that snap requirement.
It proves the mechanism is Martensitic.
Yes.
It's like finding a car stopped exactly at the edge of a cliff. You know it didn't drive off, but you also know why it stopped exactly there. It couldn't go any further without crashing.
That's a great way to put it. And the authors even addressed the skeptics. Some people argued maybe it's diffusion, but just very localized. But the authors point out that the carbon levels are just too high for that to make physical sense.
I see.
It would imply the ferrite was supersaturated in a way that's physically unreasonable for diffusion.
So let's synthesize this.
Hmm.
Based on this 1981 paper, if I could shrink down and watch bainite grow, what would I see?
You would see a violent, jerky process. One, bainite grows in small subunits, often called sheaves. Two, it is a martensitic transformation. The lattice shears instantly. We know this because the heavy atoms, the silicon and nickel, are frozen in place.
Right.
Three, it is initially fully supersaturated with carbon. It traps all the carbon inside. And four, immediately after forming, that carbon diffuses out into the remaining austenite.
And finally.
Five, this enrichment of the austenite eventually shuts the whole process down when it hits the T0 prime limit, the incomplete reaction.
It's a bit of a tragic story for the bainite. It destroys its own ability to grow.
In a way, yes. And just to put the final nail in the coffin of the diffusion theory, they did one more clever thing with the atom probe.
What's that?
They did field evaporation experiments. This is figure 3 in the paper.
I saw that graph of the distant steps.
Yes. They basically peeled the interface layer by layer, counting atoms as they went across the boundary between the bainite and the austenite.
And what were they looking for there?
If the bainite grew by diffusion, by pushing atoms ahead of it like a snowplow, you would expect a pileup of nickel or silicon right at the interface, a transient spike.
Like a ridge of snow at the edge of the plow.
Exactly. Figure 3 shows no ridge. The silicon and nickel levels are flat, just random noise, no pileup.
Wow.
Which means the interface didn't drag any atoms with it, it just jumped.
It's amazing how much information they got out of this one alloy. They really covered every angle. Bulk composition, local composition, thermodynamics, and the interface profile.
It's a masterclass in using data to distinguish between mechanisms. And doing all this with 1981 computing power, that's what really impresses me.
Right. This was manual data collection.
Today, we have 3D atom probes that collect millions of atoms in minutes. These guys were building these distributions point by point.
So bring this back to the listener. We've solved the cold case. Bainite is a snap, followed by a spit of carbon. Why does that distinction matter to someone driving a car or crossing a bridge today?
It matters because structure determines properties. If you understand that bainite forms this way trapping carbon and then rejecting it, you can engineer better steels.
How so?
For example, knowing that the reaction stops at the T0 prime line allows metallurgists to design alloys where they can control exactly how much austenite is left over.
And that leftover austenite isn't just waste?
No, it's valuable. Retained austenite can make steel tougher, able to absorb energy in a crash. By manipulating this incomplete reaction, you can tune the steel to be both super strong, thanks to the bainite, and super safe, thanks to the retained austenite.
So this paper lays the groundwork for understanding the limits of that process.
It really does.
It's the recipe for modern high-strength steel. We are literally riding around on the result of this debate.
We are. It's the fundamental physics behind the material world we live in.
As we wrap up, I just keep thinking about that incomplete reaction. It's a powerful concept, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Nature sometimes stops a process, not because it's finished, but because the process itself created an environment where it can no longer exist.
It creates its own braking mechanism. The product of the reaction chokes the reaction.
It happens in biology, it happens in economics, and apparently it happens in a glowing piece of steel at 340 degrees Celsius.
And thanks to Padacia and Wah, we have the atomic receipts to prove it.
Well, that is all the time we have for this deep dive. Hopefully we've helped you see the steel around you a little differently.
It was a pleasure. Always fun to look at the building blocks.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you in the next deep dive.